Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Pandemic Journal number 2, an essay on current events, social class, politics, the Bushes of Connecticut, how to tell Andover from Exeter, and the man known from Greenwich to Thompson as His Excellency Ned. I hope you'll stay tuned. I speak in early June 2020. New World Notes presents installment number 2 of Pandemic Journal. 3 months have passed since installment number 1. Well, there seems to be no hurry, does there? Apart from the rising death toll, growing poverty, widespread rioting, and the increasingly awful deranged clown show now playing at the White House, not a great deal has changed in 3 months, has it? As hinted at the program's very beginning, this week we focus on politics, social class, the rhetoric of names, and, inevitably, how to tell a Christian from a deranged Philistine. One of the odder byproducts of COVID-19 has been the plethora of public proclamations by the governor. The Connecticut State Legislature all decided to go AWOL in mid-March, and, last I heard, they were still AWOL 3 months later. They are happy to let the governor govern the state by proclamation. So the governor gets to decide when barbershops can open, the length of the school year, who can get unemployment compensation, and most other legislative matters. It's obviously an impossible task, and public opinion seems to be that the governor is doing quite a good job of it. He is a far cry from the bozos who have invaded the White House and are now starting to give evil, deranged clowns a bad name. So the governor governs by executive order, and some poor staffer turns his orders into official proclamations, and the state pays to have the proclamations duly published in the newspapers. Did you ever read one of these proclamations? Of course not. Nobody could. I have a fine example before me. Executive Order No. 7MM, published May 16. It fills one entire tabloid-sized newspaper page. I estimate the type size is 3 points. It spans the entire width of the page. I would guess that it displays 150 characters per line. It is all one paragraph. It is unreadable. Each proclamation begins with whereas, so I'm guessing that somewhere in the middle there's a therefore, and eventually that first sentence has got to end somewhere. But that's just a guess. What is Proclamation No. 7MM all about? Apparently, it makes it easier for restaurants to put tables out on the sidewalk. Yes, in the same number of words, Tolstoy was able to write 3 chapters of War and Peace. But not even Tolstoy could write 3 chapters that together comprised one single paragraph. That is the genius of the governor's anonymous staffer. But all that is beside the point. The other thing that strikes you about each of these proclamations is the byline at the top of the page. They all begin with this 3-line heading. Public Notice, State of Connecticut, by His Excellency Ned Lamont. Let that sink in for a moment. His Excellency Ned. Not His Excellency Edward M. Lamont, Jr., no, His Excellency Ned Lamont. You know, sort of like, now entering the cathedral, Her Majesty Lizzie Windsor, accompanied by the heir apparent, His Royal Highness Chuck Windsor. His Excellency Ned. We are living in a Dr. Seuss poem, right? Our mom will not like it. She'll twist off her head. We must get advice from His Excellency Ned. His Excellency Ned will know what to do when people have guests like Thing 1 and Thing 2. Ned. The issue here is the phony intimacy of politicians and their names. Here's why it matters. Over the past 50 years, average citizens have seen their already small role in American politics reduced still further. People used to be enlisted to canvass their neighborhoods in support of Politician X. Go door to door, collect small donations from neighbors to support his campaign, and let his lieutenants know the concerns of your neighborhood. And by gum, the politician might just arrange to get that street lamp fixed, that pothole repaired, maybe even get that rotten cop transferred. And you can show your gratitude when you go to the polls. No more. Doing something concrete to serve your interests is no longer part of any politician's campaign strategy. Instead, the politician will spend a fortune on TV commercials produced by slick marketing experts. What he needs is not the ability to get your pothole fixed, but rather tons and tons of money to produce and air all those TV commercials that will make you vote for him. And he is never going to raise tons and tons of money in your neighborhood. Hi-ho! It's off to the fat cats we go! Go fix your own stupid potholes. Among Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, between them, had massive public support, far more than Hillary Clinton had. Why did Sanders and Warren drop out of the race? Because the big money donors wanted a reliable hack who could be counted on to protect the interests of the plutocracy. So the big money went to Biden, and Warren and Sanders dropped out of the race, and the citizens be damned. Yet again. In sum, the function of both political parties at the national level is to prevent democracy. As the politicians became more and more distant from the citizens' concerns, their slick marketing experts advised giving the entirely false impression of caring for you. So, let's all address one another by first names. Not just the politician's first name, but the intimate short version of that name. The nickname, once used only by family and close friends. Remember, he's not just your senator, he's now your close personal friend. Besides, doesn't using the name on one's birth certificate sound terribly elitist? Here's an example. For most of my life, I'd hear of a very important American political figure, always referred to as Senator Robert J. Dole of Kansas. Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole. You couldn't watch the 6 o'clock news for a week without hearing something from Senator Robert J. Dole. Then, one day in 1996, as he was campaigning for presidential nomination, Senator Robert J. Dole disappeared and was instantly replaced by Bob Dole. Bob Dole. Well, the nation chose Bill over Bob. Shortly afterwards, Bob started doing TV ads for Viagra, and then he was never heard from again. Farewell, my best pal Bob, and good luck with your erectile dysfunction. One of the four good things I can say about President Trump is that he never presumed to ask me to call him Donnie. Alas, that's not true of Attorney General Bob or Senate Majority Leader Mitch, to say nothing of past presidents known as Jimmy and Bill. Kudos to Elizabeth Warren. No Lizzie Warren for her. Now comes, or came, Bernie. Look, I like the guy, and I think he's an admirable liberal Democrat, if that's your cup of tea. I even sort of like the way he pretends to be a socialist. Perhaps the working class name Bernie is part of his socialist costume play. Now, a century ago, America had a real socialist running for president, and he won nearly a million votes in 1920 while sitting in prison for condemning a gruesome, unnecessary war. And the name on the ballot read Eugene V. Debs. Not Gene, not Bernie, not Jimmy, Bill, Bob, or Ned. Eugene V. That's V for Victor. But here is my all-time favorite just plain folksy politician's name, Jeb Bush. Remember him? Yes, he's still around, though after George W., the Bushes have been lying low for a spell. But they'll be back, like the Adamses 200 years ago, or bedbugs. Once you let the first one in, others will follow, and there's really no getting rid of them. Jeb, that old cowpoke from Texas, now an old cowpoke from Florida. Jeb, do you have any idea what name appears on Jeb's birth certificate? Of course not. Jeb is an acronym for John Ellis Bush. Roll that name around on your tongue for a while, especially if you're from Connecticut. John Ellis Bush. Does that name sound just a little patrician? Does that name sound just a little like Phillips Academy Prep School? It certainly sounds like Yale, though in fact old Jeb is the only Bush in recorded history who didn't go to Yale. Anyway, does John Ellis Bush sound just a little like Prescott Bush? Senator from Connecticut, back when the U.S. Senate was rightly known as the world's most exclusive gentlemen's club. Prescott Bush, Dean of the Round Hill Country Club of Greenwich, Connecticut. Does that sound like the third bluest blood in New England? The Bushes of Connecticut, who fall right under the Cabots and the Lowells of Boston? John Ellis Bush. Prescott Bush's bouncing baby blue-blooded grandson. Jeb. Another cute preppy nickname. Did I mention the name of old Jeb's first son? It's George Prescott Bush. And his son is named Prescott Walker Bush. Let us not forget our roots. Well, never mind my best buddy, old Jeb. Let's get back to my second best buddy, old Ned. They say old Ned went and got some fancy desk job in Hartford. Ask any Democrat in Connecticut the actual name of the man they voted for governor. You might as well ask them what the guy did for a living before he became His Excellency Ned. Golly, I guess the TV ads just didn't say. But I don't want to come down hard on Ned. Today, no one could be elected running as Edward Minor Lamont Jr. Or for that matter, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That sounds far too elitist, far too upscale. The more the wealthy come to rule America, the more we'll deny that they even exist. Which, of course, is exactly what they want. Surely you wouldn't want to have a governor who went to Phillips Exeter Academy, then Harvard, then Yale, then off to live in Fairfield County, Connecticut, playing God knows how many rounds of golf at the club with Prescott Bush's great-grandchildren. Would you? That's old Ned I'm talking about, not good old Jeb. Jeb went to Phillips Academy in Andover, not Phillips Exeter. The name Ned sounds like just plain folks to us rubes who imagine America is both democratic and class-free, rubes who don't know their Andover from their Exeter. But to those in the know, Ned sounds awfully like a prep school nickname, especially if the bearer is not named Edmund, but rather Edward. Not unlike Mr. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, known to all his prep school drinking buddies, not as Brett, but as Bart. Anyway, I will not single out for abuse the man now called His Excellency Ned. His performance in running the state during the pandemic has been admirable. Then his response to the unrest following the police murder of George Floyd was even more admirable. He displayed tact, empathy, restraint, and an impressive moral compass. And apparently he read the Riot Act, not to the protesters, but to the police. He is a stunning contrast with our national misleadership. Back in the days when governors had names like Edward Minor Lamont, we would have said he showed a great deal of class. We can't say dirty things like that anymore, now that we are class-free and have governors named Ned or Jeb. And in Massachusetts, God help them, they've got a Charlie. Charlie, ending in I-E. I like to think that in Connecticut, we have not sunk quite low enough to elect a Charlie. I like to think that in Connecticut, he'd have to campaign as Chuck. Unless his last name was Bush. In that case, all bets are off. But let us think some more about social class and social unrest and murder and the Honorable Ned and how these all connect with one another. You probably heard of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Ned himself described the act as murder, and good for him. And as you know, this touched off public protests throughout the world, especially throughout the United States, even throughout Connecticut, even in the provincial town east of the river in which I live. And in many cities elsewhere, mass protests met with the usual excessive force by police. And in many cities elsewhere, riots broke out at night with the typical window smashing, looting, and arson. Interestingly enough, none of this happened in Connecticut. Not that it couldn't have. Connecticut has three old, large, declining cities: Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport. These cities are majority poor, majority black, majority fed up with poverty, racial oppression, government indifference, and, particularly, police violence. All saw very large, peaceful protests, with citizens of all races taking to the streets, saying, "Enough is enough, I can't breathe." His Excellency Ned responded very adroitly. And, coincidentally or not, there were no riots in the state of Connecticut, no burning, no looting, and even very few reports of excessive force used by any police officer in the state. In Waterbury, 28 people were arrested for minor offenses, mostly for blocking roads. And that was the worst of it. Police claimed that these people were from splinter groups, not from the main demonstration, which was entirely unmolested. That could actually be the truth. My guess is that word had filtered down from higher up, quite possibly from a guy who now held emergency powers and had no legislature to undercut him. I'm guessing the police received word that they had better be on their best behavior, or the heads of several chiefs will roll. In Hartford, some citizens laid down across Interstate 84, blocking traffic. In New Haven, likewise on Interstate 95. State police managed to clear both highways without beating anyone up, without even arresting anyone, in fact. In a conference call to governors on June 1, Donald Trump and Attorney General Bob berated governors for not cracking down on protesters forcefully enough. quote, "You've got to dominate the battlefield," unquote, advised the nation's draft dodger-in-chief. According to Ned, Trump said, "What's the matter with you governors? How come you're not out there showing these guys who's boss? If you don't run over, you're going to get run over. How come you're not using the National Guard? How come you're not arresting more people?" His Excellency Ned continued, "This is the opposite of what we're trying to do here in Connecticut." The president's admonition to turn this into a military-type situation just pours gasoline on the flames. Later on the day of that conference call, June 1, President Trump had federal troops use tear gas, flashbang grenades, and horsemen to bulldoze peaceful protesters out of the way so he could walk across the street, stand before a fire-damaged Episcopal church, and wave a Bible in a get-tough-on-crime photo op. He then ditched the Bible and was escorted back to the White House. At this point, words failed your humble reporter. That's me. Fortunately, words did not fail the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C., and she shared a few choice ones with the public. The next day, 9 Episcopal bishops throughout New England seconded that opinion. I mean, rioters, intentionally or unintentionally, had damaged a church building. The President of the United States had just expressed his contempt for the church, expressed his contempt for the book that Christians consider to be the sacred word of God, and expressed his contempt for every principle the church stands for, all the while trying to pass himself off as a Christian. The president had already given demented clowns a bad name. Now he was starting to give Philistines a bad name. In 1977, the journalist and novelist Joan Didion wrote a wonderful essay on class in America. It focuses on 2 buildings in Sacramento, California, the old governor's mansion and the new governor's residence. I will summarize. The old mansion was a wonderful old Victorian confection, full of delights and surprises, perfectly suited to nurture every important part of human life. Didion knew the mansion inside and out, for in her later childhood, she was friends with the governor's daughter. That was Governor Earl Warren, establishment Republican, country club type, a man of good taste and good breeding. In other words, old money. Even more than money, the Warrens had class, and so did the official governor's residence. In came a new governor, also a Republican. His name was Ronald Reagan, the former Hollywood actor. New money, with new money friends. First Lady Nancy had the old mansion condemned as a fire trap. The legislature approved the building of a new governor's residence. Pals of Ronald donated some land, and the state of California proceeded to build the most expensive residence constructed to that date in Sacramento County. Governor Reagan's term expired just before the buildings and grounds were completely finished. The new house is a ghastly, single-story eyesore. Its architecture is all in the open plan, entirely unfit for civilized living. Every material used is fake. Fake redwood timbers, fake marble vinyl countertops, fake adobe walls. There is no privacy, nothing to contain noise, no feature that is the slightest bit conducive to human life, let alone family life. It resembles, if anything, the lobby of a Ramada Inn. In sum, the ghastly new residence has absolutely no class. It is a stunning contrast to the lovely old mansion, just as the tasteless Reagans are a stunning contrast to the genteel Warrens. So utterly devoid of class is the new governor's residence that no politician in California will have anything to do with the joint. Rather than live there, the then-new governor, Jerry Brown, a Democrat, is living in a small apartment that he's paying for out of his own paycheck. But, Didion continues, no politician will say why they don't like that vulgar monstrosity. They have to make up excuses like, it's too far from the Capitol. How come? Because half the voters in California, people with no more taste or class than the Reagans, think the new residence is lovely, a dream house, as wonderful as Disneyland. An election is always coming up, and you need the votes of all those vulgarians. As Didion sees it, social classes do exist in America, and the upper classes do have some virtues that the lower classes lack. And among the rich, old money people have many more virtues than new money people. The historical change from the old governor's mansion to the new governor's residence shows in a nutshell much of what has gone wrong with America over the years. And nobody will speak the truth of the change. Because to speak the truth, one must talk about class, and even to mention class is absolutely taboo in America. Didion ends the essay with these words on the new residence. I have seldom seen a house so evocative of the unspeakable. The essay is titled Many Mansions. Joan Didion wrote it in 1977. It is collected in her book, The White Album. Ask for it in that temple of successful American socialism, your public library, if and when the library ever opens up again. The Californians thought they had hit rock bottom with Governor Reagan, little dreaming that Reagan's political star was only beginning to rise, little dreaming that rock bottom had not yet even been approached. To his credit, even the vulgarian Reagan never stooped so low as to scatter peaceful protesters with horse, tear gas, and flashbang grenades so he could pose for 1 minute waving a Bible in front of a church he had not entered since assuming office, thereby turning two serious national crises into a sleazy campaign ad and committing sacrilege in anybody's book. No, Joan, in 1977, when it comes to total absence of class, you were nowhere near rock bottom yet. For Pandemic Journal and for New World Notes, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you good health, a plentiful supply of toilet paper, and a safe and sane St. Swithin's Day. And next time you're in Hartford, consider dropping by Connecticut's own Governor's Mansion, 990 Prospect Avenue, and say hi and thanks to your best old pal, His Excellency Ned.